This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Trump's long-awaited tax reform plan, which he promised would help working-class Americans during the campaign, is being slammed by Democrats, not hard enough, for being too lenient, though, to big corporations at the expense of the middle class. Why, it's little more than an across-the-board tax cut for America's millionaires and billionaires, said Bernie Sanders, who continued at a time of massive wealth and income inequality. President Trump's tax plan is morally repugnant and bad economic policy. The last thing we should be doing right now is providing hundreds of billions in tax breaks to the wealthiest people and the most profitable corporations in this country. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka responded to the Trump tax plan, saying it is nothing but a con game, and working people are the ones they're trying to con. Here we go again. First comes the promise that tax giveaways for the wealthy and big corporations will trickle down to the rest of us. Then comes the promise that tax cuts will pay for themselves. Then comes the promise that they want to stop offshoring. And finally, we find out none of these things are true, and the people responsible for wasting trillions of dollars on tax giveaways to the rich tell us we have no choice but to cut Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, education, and infrastructure. We're joined now by Dr. William Spriggs, Chief Economist of the AFL-CIO and Professor of Economics at Howard University, to tell it like it is. The Trump tax plan.
Thank you for having me today.
Entirely our pleasure. So as the Senate tax bill passes, as votes split there along party lines, Dr. Spriggs, let's begin by elaborating on some of the most repugnant, as Bernie Sanders put it, terrible proposals included in the Trump tax debacle. Debacle certainly for working people, for the working class of this country.
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start, but in the name of tax reform, a lot of people will get a tax increase. And so for everyone making less than $150,000, it's a little hard to figure out how much of a tax cut as they promise you would get, because there are so many people in that group who are going to get a tax increase. So among the bad ideas that they have, one that got a lot of attention yesterday because there were a lot of graduate assistants on Capitol Hill sending letters to members of Congress, delivering them by hand, is the idea that we would treat the tuition waiver that graduate students get for being teaching assistants or research assistants, we would treat that waiver. So this is not money that they physically receive, but theoretically receive, as income. So a graduate assistant who makes $20,000 as a teaching assistant or research assistant and gets a $60,000 tuition waiver would now be treated as if they made $80,000 a year and would have to pay taxes on the $80,000, even though they only get $20,000 in cash. That would be catastrophic. That would raise the cost to education for those students. We've already heard the cost that we are raising to students because we're not going to let them deduct the interest on their student loans. So for people who have struggled to work their way and claw their way to the middle class by getting education, the first set of payments that they're making are mostly interest payments. So as you start out and you're not making that much money after you graduate, we're not going to punish them and say, well, you can't deduct that interest payment. We want to tax you on that. you live in a high state tax or local tax jurisdiction, we now want to double tax you. And this shows the bias in the way that tax economists think about tax reform. So people have argued in the past that if you are in a state where the state taxes are high and the local taxes are high, that's because the state and local government are providing lots of services like better elementary school education, better high school education, better transportation, better safety. And you should treat that as a consumable, and therefore you shouldn't say that, well, it's just a tax because people in those areas get better services, so you ought to tax that, not treat that state and local tax as if it were a tax. Now, the reality is that if you happen to live in one of the states that have higher state and local tax, yes, it's true. Those states do have better K through 12 education systems. They do have better transportation systems. And people in those states make more money. But they also pay much more in federal tax than their states receive from the federal government. So New York, as an example, ships federal dollars south to Kentucky and Mississippi and South Carolina and Alabama, the states that don't pay high state and local taxes. So if you looked at this from a different perspective, this is not a distortion of the tax system that we're not understanding, that people in New York consume more public goods. Is that's a good thing that their states do those things, because that's how you get higher income in your state, by having those better public services. And so why discourage that? Why discourage states from going above federal mandates? And why discourage states by punishing them, in essence, because they do go above those federal mandates, and those are the states that provide most of the revenue for the United States federal treasury? Why do we then want to punish those states by saying, all that money that you ship south, never mind. This is the source of how those other states stay above water for not doing what they're supposed to do. So that's another perversion. So we see them go after some of these perversions. They have decided that they're going to tax the endowments of our richest universities. We can have a long debate about what we should be expecting of some of those universities when it comes to the students they admit. We know that disproportionately they admit students from the top 1%, but not all of them. And those endowments allow them to offer education to lower-income students for free in many cases, or middle-income students at far reduced tuition. So taxing those endowments doesn't make sense in the abstract. Perhaps you could say if your endowment doesn't do more to help low-income or middle-income students go to these very well-endowed schools, then we should be looking at it. But it's unfair to do it broadly. The attack on the state and local tax, the attack on the graduate students, the attack on students who have to borrow money to go to college, the attack on the endowments of the private colleges, all of those are attacks that will make it difficult to make high-quality college education affordable. All of those combined will increase the cost of higher education tremendously, tremendously. Mm. Now, this doesn't get scored by the CBO, but that's what they do. So I just bring those up to show how surgical they are in attacking a very key element of the source of future growth in the U.S., and then they turn around and give a tax cut if you buy a private jet. So you see, this isn't really tax reform. Why are you going after, in a surgical way, specific tax structures that help to create a middle class, and then turn around and say, oh, but if you buy a private jet, oh, well, you know, we got to give you a tax break. My goodness, this will really help stir job creation. You're going, what? So this is the problem. It's clear when you see things like that that are so incongruous that you can see that this is not about a tax cut that is meant to rationalize taxes. It's really about how can we give as much money to the rich as we can afford. And then you see the other things that they do. So they, in the Senate bill, they want to withdraw the private mandate to buy health insurance. That will cut the deficit. So this is where they get some of their savings against the tax cut. Why does it cut the deficit? Because it means the federal government won't be subsidizing people who buy health insurance because they won't be able to afford health insurance. So since fewer people will be buying health insurance and the federal government won't have to assist them in buying it because they've been priced out of the market, and this ends up being millions of Americans, 4 million initially, and then the number grows, and the number of people who won't have health insurance, this is the quote-unquote savings. So we're going to have a less healthy nation. So we're going to have a less educated nation, a less healthy nation. Mm-hmm. And then the individual deduction when you have medical expenses, and that deduction is only reached if you have a high level of medical deduction. So these are people who are very ill and have diseases and conditions that require individuals to spend large amounts of money. We're saying, well, you don't get to deduct those. So we're going after the health of people by increasing the cost of private health insurance tremendously, and everyone will see a dramatic increase in their health insurance premium, including people who are insured. So this affects all of us. We're all going to pay more for health insurance. All of us will pay more for health insurance. More of us won't have it. And people who have extreme health bills won't get help anymore because they won't be able to deduct those. Well, why do you need to do that in the name of tax reform and then turn around and say, oh, but, you know, you got to have a private jet because, my goodness, what would life be without a private jet? You got to have a tax credit for that. So that, you know, you put those together and go, this cannot possibly be. There's no way to justify those attacks on the middle class. These are our pathways to the middle class. You get education, and you do your best to be healthy. You get educated, and you're well enough so you can show up to work.
But
those are the two cornerstones of being middle class.
But we know that this trickles down, that it stimulates the economy, that these tax breaks for corporations, they will reinvest, and that will stimulate jobs. Or will it?
Right. So, you know, they ran this game on us before. In 2001, George W. Bush came in after the greatest expansion in U.S. economic history and said, oh, that expansion wasn't good enough. Sounds very similar to the story we just heard after the second greatest expansion in U.S. economic history. We need a massive tax cut so that we can do better than, you know, we did in the 90s. And we gave corporations huge tax breaks. And what did they do with them? Did they raise wages? No. Did they hire more Americans? No. What they did with the money was they shipped it to China, and hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs in the middle of an economic expansion. In the middle of an expansion, when Americans were demanding more products because they were buying more homes, the biggest growth in home ownership and home building took place from 2001 to 2007, our demand for refrigerators, sofas, flooring, all went through the roof. And that demand was met not by companies saying, oh, we have this huge tax break. Let's dig in. Let's invest more money in North Carolina and build more furniture. Let's invest more money in Iowa and build more refrigerators. No! They shipped all those jobs to China. So we gave them an expanding economy. We gave them a tax break. And they gave our jobs away. They pocketed the tax break. Today, after the second greatest expansion in economic history for the United States, these corporations are running record profits. Profits are at the highest level they have ever been in the United States, ever. They have trillions of dollars in cash. What do they do with it currently? Do they accelerate the rate of job growth? No, they haven't been doing much of that. It's been growing at the same rate during the whole expansion. They continue to take that money and either buy other companies or buy back their own stock or declare huge dividends, which they then collect tax-free. Or they've been hiding the money offshore because they get huge tax breaks somewhere else. Now, the argument has been, well, they wouldn't hide the money if we lowered our tax rate. But you can't lower your tax rate to what these tax shelters are doing. The Cayman Islands, Bermuda, the Jersey Islands in Great Britain, Ireland, none of them care about having huge levels of revenue because they're tiny little islands and a couple of million dollars, and, you know, they're in seventh heaven. So you can never compete with one of those locations because they don't need much money to run a country. And so this, you know, myth that these holding companies that are used to hide all the money would somehow or another go away, well, that's not going to happen. And the corporations who currently have the money are going to continue to do stock buybacks. And we're writing a blank check for them. We're telling them, we saw what you did in 2000. You took all the money and took that excess money and said, oh, now we have money so we can invest in China, so we can ship American jobs away. And now we're told, well, give them even more money, and they're going to do something different. If you believe that, that's, you know, shameful. It's shameful if you fall for that line again. It's just shame on you. And what it really does is make the Republican Party such a party of extremes. Because now they're saying, we would rather back the election of a pedophile to ensure that we can get these tax cuts. And we would be happier to have a pedophile representing a state in the United States Senate. A pedophile. The only place you should be discussing where you would put a pedophile if it's not in jail, I don't know where that would be. Maybe psychiatric help. Then we can have a discussion. But in the United States Senate? But, you know, maybe you think they're a big, giant psychiatric ward because this bill is so crazy. Maybe you think another crazy person in there can't make a difference. But that's what they're willing to do. And to not have the moral gumption, moral compass, to say, wait, are we really saying that we're that desperate to be even wealthier? Are we that greedy? Are we that shameful? And the fact that it's not making them slow up, in fact, it's making them speed up the process because they want this victory before the potential that they might lose that seat. And unfortunately, the people of Alabama seem quite prepared to elect a pedophile. It is nothing short of frightening.
And what does this implicate politically if the Senate and House reconcile the bills and the Trump tax plan essentially passes? Yeah, there'll be some tweaking, but if it passes primarily as is, what does it mean politically in the years to come about a consolidation of a plutocratic rule over us? How do you analyze and understand the ramifications for the rule of this country and thus democratic process and certainly the rights of working people who are the ones that have built this country and created the wealth?
Well, it will make us permanently Mexico. This tax bill will make us Mexico because the level of wealth inequality that we have is already the worst the United States has ever had. Our income inequality compared to other nations that are industrialized, the only nations that are industrialized that have worse income inequality are Mexico and Turkey. And this tax cut, because of the way it treats the estate tax, means that forever, the Walton and the Koch family, who own more wealth than 75% of the American people, understand that the wealth of a nation, who owns America, is held by a very small, very, very small set of people. Their wealth will be cemented forever. This will be the kingdom of the Waltons and the Kochs. That's not hyperbole. That's the reality. It will cement that. There will be no way to alter it because this provision to give corporations this amount of tax-free money will rob our treasury of the types of things that we need to redress income inequality because we won't be able to make the investments in the education and health of the American people, all in the name of cementing the wealth of a very tiny group of people. And that mechanism will make the wealth inequality grow worse because there will be no pathway for people at the bottom to ever get to the middle and for the middle to ever get to the top. Income inequality crushes income mobility. Countries with the levels of income inequality we have in the United States do not have income mobility. The great story that we like to tell, the American dream, be poor, but look at the great opportunities before you. But those great opportunities are you live in a state or a local government that makes the investment in your education, provides you with transportation to get to a job, and provides adequate health care so that you can be healthy enough to do all of that. Those are fundamental. And if you don't do those, you can't have income mobility. And you can't have that income mobility when this happens. So we're going to change our political system. Because this victory by the wealthy will mean that the 1% not only get the bulk of the economic votes because they own most of the country, and in the way the economy functions, it's $1, one vote. It's not one person, one vote. But now they will have had the victory in our government. They will have bought our government. They will have bought the United States Senate. They will have bought the United States House of Representatives, and they would show that they have the ability to buy Congress. And therefore, how would you ever get legislation that could correct it? And since you've robbed the Treasury, how could Congress ever correct it? So this is dangerous to our democracy. It's highly dangerous to our democracy. And for people to fall for it and for people who think, oh, well, but President Trump said that I'm going to get a tax cut. And look, it's a lottery for anybody who's making less than $150,000. Total lottery as to whether you will get a tax cut. We know that the tax breaks that you are going to get are going to fade away because the point of this is to give a permanent cut to corporations and to the wealthy because we're going to make the estate tax permanent and we're going to deny you access to health. So the problem is, in 5 years, everybody else gets a tax raise unambiguously. And then, as I pointed out, there are all these losers. So there are going to be people in New York who are middle class who are going to get a tax raise. This is a tax raise for most middle-income people in New York, particularly if you borrowed money to go to college to get to the middle class. Your taxes are going up. So we're raising taxes on those people.
And I'm afraid that we're going to have to leave it there, Professor Spriggs. But thank you for deconstructing the essential components and the essence of what, as you have stated, will permanently alter the rule of this country and so further create the wealth divide that is shredding democratic promise as well. And we have been speaking with Dr. William Sprigg, Chief Economist of the AFL-CIO and Professor of Economics at Howard University. And thanks for lifting the veil from our eyes. And now we've got the work of some serious, serious protests. Get on the horn with your legislators and say hell no to the Trump tax plan. Not reform, tax plan. Dr. Spriggs, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and like everybody says, not one penny. Not one penny to these rich people.
I can go with that. Indeed. That's our motto. Thank you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.